Plateau. This is the Benue World Order, Episode 7, Season X. Let's get started with our Fortune of the Day, which is now officially a tradition. So we've got breakfast.com, halted, serial port not responding. I get it. Okay, so I thought it might be cool also, in addition to being to doing a Fortune of the Day, to do an Emacs tip of the day, or show, really. It's not Fortune of the Day, it's Fortune of the Show. But anyway, Emacs tip. And this is basically because there are a lot of really cool Emacs tips out there. I mean, there's so much you can do with Emacs, and it is such a thoroughly geeky application. I know that, I mean, you know, the joke would be for me to say something about Vim not being very good or whatever. I'm an Emacs user who fell into it. I was interested in using Emacs for the longest time. I could not get my foot in that door. Just could not really get into it. And I tried going through that Emacs tutorial, and I tried. Didn't really work out for me. And what really changed it was a boss of mine at a job got me into using Emacs as the main environment at this job. And that was it. That got me really using Emacs. And once you start using it, you kind of get addicted. So let me give you a taste. So this is the Emacs tip of the day. And it's not very focused, but I do want to talk a little bit about buffer management in Emacs. This assumes that you're not terribly familiar with Emacs, but that you're willing to try a couple of things. So let's talk about buffers and how to manage them. So here we are with Emacs, and the cool thing about Emacs, as you probably have heard, is that there are lots of things that you can do just by nature of it being itself, which seems weird. But here's like the example. So if we say create file buffer, for instance, why isn't that auto-completing? There you go, file, create file buffer, and this is just in the scratch buffer. This buffer here, this is called the scratch buffer. As the note says, this buffer is for you to create notes that you don't want to save, and for Lisp evaluation, if you wanted to create a file, visit that file with Control-X, Control-F, then enter the text in that file's buffer. So it warns you pretty clearly from the get-go that if I close Emacs right now, everything that I've typed will be gone. It's a scratch buffer. So if I type in parentheses or bracket in some languages, create-file-buffer, close parentheses, and then hit Control-J, it tells me that I put that in wrong, probably. So I forgot to give it a name, actually, is what I forgot to do. So, and this isn't even my point. I just want you to see that sort of how Emacs is doing all of this stuff in the background. So, Control-J now, then it says, hey, so what I've typed for people not watching is bracket create dash file dash buffer space quote foo end quote end bracket or parentheses. So and then it tells me on the next line buffer foo. That doesn't really say a whole lot if you're not used to how Emacs responds to you, but in fact I have created a buffer called foo. So if I do Control X and then B, and we'll do this again together slower, I just want to show you that indeed it did create a buffer called foo. There you go. Buffer name is foo, and it's an empty buffer. It's a file buffer, meaning, you know, it's a window that you can type into. So I'm going to get rid of that. So that's the Lisp side of things. It's a simple little function, I guess, of Lisp. So anytime that you have an Emacs window, as we do here, everything that you're looking at, sort of the part where you type into, is a buffer, a file buffer. And we can start typing, and now we've got a buffer. This is a buffer. Specifically, this is a scratch, the scratch buffer. So there you go. Now we could write that file out with Control X, Control W, And that down in the bottom here tells you, okay, you're going to write this file, and we could call it testfile.file, and now it has been saved. And now if I close Emacs, that file will exist, which is kind of nice. But it wouldn't unless you had saved it specifically. And of course, if you open up other files, for instance, if I go into a folder to try to find a file to open, you can see what's happening. I'm hitting tab, the tab key, and as an auto-completion, it splits my Emacs window into half vertically and opens this sort of dynamic buffer. It's auto-completion buffer, I guess, and it's telling me what folders are in the path that I'm trying to complete. And the cool thing about at least the GUI version of Emacs is that you can interact with it in a variety of different ways. You can either click on the selections that you want to try out, and it auto-completes it down here in the mini buffer at the bottom. That's what I had just clicked on, and then I can hit tab a couple more times. Or you can type it in, and it will complete it for you. So there's a lot of different ways to kind of handle that. But the other way to do all of this, and I can't find my slides for some reason. They should be in here. They're not even really slides. They're just... Oh, sides? No, slides. Well, anyway. The buffer kind of opens when it needs to autocomplete, and once you kind of figure it out, you can kind of send it away and tell it not to bother you anymore. So that's kind of nice. But it's not necessarily what I want to show you. So let's create something here at random. So I'll create a file called foo again. And so now I've got this new file, and it's called foo, and I can certainly type into this simple. But the nice thing about Emacs as well is that you can split up your workspace. So not only do you have this dynamic auto-completion buffer that kind of appears out of nowhere if you're auto-tab completing, you can split that up yourself. So if I do Control X and then the number 3, that splits it up vertically. And right now, since I only have two buffers, or one active buffer, it splits it and gives me the same file in either side. But I can either click on whichever window I want to be in. Again, they're both the same, so right now it's functionally, you know, kind of the same thing. Or I can hit Control X O for other, and that moves to the other buffer. You can kind of see that with my cursor if you're watching. So what we'll do here is go over to the right and let's open up some other file, and I guess for lack of any actual demonstration, let's see if we can find a nice config file to open at least. Yeah, here we go. So here's my QTractor configuration file. So there, that's opened. That's nice. So in one side of my Emacs file, or window rather, I have my QTractor.conf file. And then if I hit Control X O for other, then I'm in my new foo file buffer. Now, the coolness doesn't really start there. We could split this up again. So if I hit Control X and then the number 2, that gives me a horizontal split in whatever current buffer I'm in. So I do this a lot, especially for something that's called dir-ed. I don't really even know what that stands for, to be honest. Never really occurred to me to even think about it. But it's this little file view, and you can bring that up just by hitting Alt-X, not Control-X, but Alt-X, and then just the phrase dir-ed, which is D-I-R-E-D. And that gives you a little file view of any directory that you want to look at. And I use that really, really frequently. This is something that I do all the time because it's really handy to have sort of your file manager right here in Emacs. And then, of course, you can hit Control XO and go to another buffer. And you can kind of cycle through all of your open buffers just with Control X, Control O. Now, you can also swap out what's in a buffer. So let's say that I decide that my configuration file here, which is quite long actually, it's got a lot of lines in it, would be better suited in my larger file buffer, where it fits a little bit better. To do that, you do Control X B for buffer, and that switches to a different buffer. So right now I'm in my test file dot file file, and what I want to be in, I can just cycle through the little list here with the up and down arrow, is my qtractor.conf. And so now that opens up in the long tall buffer, and then I can hit Control X O to go to my other buffer on the other side and switch buffers to foo. So that's kind of how you manage buffers in Emacs, I guess. Now, if you get tired of having a buffer open, for instance, maybe I don't want foo open anymore, I could kill it with Control X K for kill, and it's warning me that it's been modified, and do I really want to kill it? So I'm saying yes to that. And it just switches to the next available buffer, which happens to be qtractor.conf. But again, I can hit Control X and then B, and that'll cycle through all the other things that I have. And this one is, oh, the other one was called foo. This one is test file.file. So that used to be the scratch buffer. And probably to make that clearer, I should take that out. Okay, so now let's say, again, that I'm really tired of having all of these buffers open for whatever reason, and, I mean, this is kind of my normal setup, so probably I wouldn't be tired of this, but let's say I was. You can just kind of do away with your splits with Control X 0, which gets rid of the current, it kind of zaps the buffer where you are at that moment, or you can do Control X1, which keeps the current buffer that you're in and kills the other, or makes invisible the other one. It pushes that off the screen, as it were. Because, of course, the qtractor.conf, we didn't close it, so it's still open, and we can get there by Control XB again. It's just we don't have the split anymore. We can bring the split back, and then we can switch back to the qtractor.conf file. And then we could kill another, the other buffer. So yeah, that's kind of how that works. Control X 0 and 1. So 0, you kind of think of 0 being obliterating something, nullifying something. So if you're in a current buffer and you do Control X 0, then that current buffer will go away, or that current split will go away. Current window, I guess, is what they call it in Emacs. Whereas if you do a Control X 1, then that one stays and the other one goes away. So it's kind of, if you think about it, it makes sense. So that's controlling buffers in Emacs, and I really should do a feature on dir-ed sometime, because it's a really cool little feature, but I'm not going to right now because this was just supposed to be a tip. And that's about it for buffers. I could talk probably more, but it would get boring. But, I mean, it's a lot of fun. You should try Emacs and start playing around with how to use the buffers wisely and progressively. So the thing I wanted to talk about today really is all about, I would say it's all about files, but it's not really all about files. But it's desktop-related stuff. And there's one thing that has amazed me as something that we could really work on in the Linux community is this concept of the file chooser. And as you know, well, first of all, I should define what a file chooser is. So the file chooser, that's what I call it. I'm sure there are other terms for it. But the file chooser, file selection, I don't know. File chooser is the interface that you are presented with when you are opening files, saving as,
exporting. That's probably about it. So it's that window that pops up, whether you're in LibreOffice and you're saving a document, or you're in GIMP and you're opening a document or exporting a document, whether you're in Blender, whether you're in Krita, Kate, you name it, there's probably an interface that pops up when you go to open or save a file that you have to navigate. Now, the thing about the file chooser, and this is not a Linux only issue, this happens other places, but the thing about file choosers is that right now they are specific, you know, they're local, they're all local, they're local to the application that owns them, and that's always puzzled me. I don't know why that is. I mean, there's probably a very good reason as to why. I mean, there is a reason. It's you as the programmer, you're writing your code, and you're using whatever tool set, like whatever framework that you're using in order to generate the graphical environment that you're writing. And though each framework basically has their own, you know, they've got that implemented already. So if you're programming in either Python or C++ and you're using Qt, then, you know, when you define the file menu and you define that there's going to be an open action or a save action, you connect that to the Qt open, you know, load file thing or save file thing, and it that's all you have to do as the programmer. So it's very much in your interest to do that, because that's code you don't have to write. So that, I mean, it's a great feature in programming environments, but it to me, it just seems like one of those things that shouldn't be local to the framework. That's a very abstract concept. We need a way to open files and save files. Do we need to re-implement it every single framework? Maybe we do. I really don't know enough about, like, the low-level memory management side of things where, you know, where I can make a call to a system and say, yes, I want this file chooser to open up. But in my mind, I'm thinking that there's probably a way. And in my mind, I would think it was kind of like a free desktop.org specification, like the xdg-open, xdg-whatever, like these sort of generic calls that you could make to the system that you're on. And you just say, hey, open up X file chooser. And whatever X file chooser is set to on that person's system is the one that would then pop up. I think that would be a really, really cool feature. And again, this is not Linux only, although on Linux, I think we see a lot more of it than on a lot of other platforms, because on a lot of other platforms, everything's kind of bundled up from one or two vendors. You know, you tend to use the very vendor-specific tools because it's closed source and it's concentrated on there being, you know, very, very specific packages from very specific places. But if you start dipping your toes into a lot of, like, independent and open source applications, even on other other platforms, you do start to see this a lot more. And you do see it even, like, the minute you go third party on any platform, I'm trying to say, is you're going to see variation. And on Linux, since basically everything is third party, you see this a lot. Let's take a look. I'll show you just how often we see this.
So for instance, there's GIMP, which you probably know the file chooser quite well, especially if you are a GNOME user already. So if I go to File, Open in GIMP, we get this sort of similar, or this familiar, rather, looking file chooser with your little edit button up here and your little controls there, and you can do all kinds of things, and it's got the panel on the side, and it's kind of like your standard. I mean, this is from what I recall of GNOME, which has been a while, to be honest, since I've used it just as of late, but from what I can remember, this is basically, you know, this is kind of a Nautilus setup, essentially. So that's one. And that's used by a lot of the the GNOME-ic kinds of things, you know, because it's just the one that you, if you're writing GTK software, that's the one they give you, and it's easy to use. So here's Kwrite, for instance, just as a random example, and that's where we are, and this is kind of vaguely familiar to probably most people who use KDE, because this is kind of the standard, pretty much standard order file chooser for KDE. Simple. You've got the spanner icon and lots of different kinds of choices that you can make, different views, detailed views, icon views, and so on. You got controls up at the top, you have preview, refresh, up a level, back a level, and so on. And you got your side panel on the on down one side, and you can create, or you can have more or fewer sort of panels as you want, like a side preview. So if you've got like a if you've got some file, oh, that's not going to give me a preview because it just opens. But yeah, so you've got different options, and that's pretty familiar. Again, you're going to find that in most KDE applications. So now let's look at something like this GUI front end to CVS, which, okay, admittedly, you know, it's not really something that most of us actually use, but here we go. And this is actually vaguely familiar probably to you if you use like Amarok as well. This is kind of the setup that they do for that. It's kind of this sort of, again, the side view, side panel on the far left, and the actual meat of everything is a tree view, and there's not, as far as I know, there's not really a way to change that. That's just kind of like, that's the view that you get. I don't know of any way to really alter that at all. So that's it's a Qt based file chooser, I'm assuming, and that's kind of what you get with a couple of different applications. So here we've got another one. We've got Qt Creator, which presumably, and I haven't actually verified this lately, but presumably it's using just a straight, you know, no KDE library, straight Qt kind of file chooser. And that's, it's similar to KDE. You see where KDE certainly got, you know, got everything from, but it is still unique, especially the buttons up here in the upper right corner. You know, you've got a different set of selections, different set of options, create new folder. To me, it's a little bit more like, it looks more like the Java one, and I don't mean that in a, like a cliche bad, like, oh, Java is a horrible thing way. I just mean that's what it reminds me of, but that's just me. Yeah, and you've got your nice little menu here, which is kind of nice. So, up at the top, so yeah, but it's, again, unique. So I'm launching a FluidSynth front end right now. It's a DSSI, or Dizzy plugin, for music making, and I'm going to load a sound font, and this is what I wanted to see. This is a more traditional, from what I can tell, sort of an X, you know, just kind of generic X11 kind of old school file chooser with things sort of on the left here being the directory view, and then things in the right being files, so folders and files, which, you know, if you're used to modern file choosers, it gets a little bit confusing, or at least it does to me, because I'm not used to this, which isn't the worst thing in the world. I got used to it, but I'm just saying it is confusing because you're kind of trained to think that there's sort of a flow from left to right, like, you know, like I should be seeing the contents of the left panel in the right, which it is, but it's not exactly, because it's just the files of whatever directory you're in on the left are listed in the right panel. So it's a little bit weird, but whatever. So yeah, there's that. So a lot of these things, I admit, are a little bit contrived. These aren't actually things that I necessarily use all the time, but this is the, I guess, geeky image viewer, I guess is what it's called. I don't know how to say it, obviously, but yeah, if I go to open, then again, you've got, this is familiar, this is like the Fluid Synth one, but it is, it's unique, it is specific to this program, as far as I can tell. Open collection, you got your home, you got a new folder button on the left, you've got a sort of a panel over here on the far left, but it's unique. You know, if someone had dragged and dropped or added side panels in GIMP and then came out to Geeky to look at the results, they would see that the thing that they had added to this panel was not there. It's not something that it pulls from any kind of system-wide configuration. It's completely unique. And then there are no labels here, so if you're not really used to this way of working, it's really difficult to know kind of where to go. And I have to say, I'm not that used to working this way, and I have to admit that I'm quite confused. So there we go. You've got other extreme examples, I guess you could call them. XMMS, which is a great little music player. I love it, but it, once again, it's kind of confusing in terms of how to navigate it, and that's because it's got its own little file chooser. I mean, it's similar. You know, there's the very sort of common theme of a tree view, which you can kind of figure out pretty quickly, but it is, again, unique unto itself. And it's not even necessarily something, well, these are just X applications and they have their own way of doing things, because XPDF here has a completely, you know, yet a different file picker, which again, is completely sort of all its own file picker, not the most beautiful or even necessarily the most functional of file viewers, but there you go. Like, and actually I literally don't even know, I guess that's, I'm not really sure how to get out of a directory once you're in it, to be honest. Yeah, so that's a different one. So those are the main ones that we see, I guess, and the important thing I think that I feel about this more than anything is the fact that when people drag a folder into here's Zebra 01, I don't even know what that is, to be honest. I'm not even sure if it's mine. I guess it must be. It's on my computer. So I'm going to drag it over here to the left panel in Krita. So now it's in Krita. If I go to Kate, for instance, which is a KDE application, and go to my open, then Zebra-01 is in my side panel. That's expected. That I would say is fairly, that's what I want to see. And now if I go to GIMP, which is definitely a related application, I mean, they're both graphic manipulation applications, and I go to File, Open, as you can see, or you'll just have to take my word for it if you're not watching the video, in the side panel, Zebra 01 is not there, because it was added from a KDE application, and not, you know, it didn't carry over to the GTK one, and certainly, you know, much less any of the applications that kind of do their own thing. Just not there. So, I mean, that's a little bit confusing for people, I think, and it's a little bit annoying for people who use the stuff all the time. I mean, you kind of expect for that stuff to be system-wide and to carry over.
But yeah, that's my idea for maybe an improvement on the desktop experience. And I think that would be one of those cool things that someone could work towards. I mean, heck, I'd work towards it, except I've got a long way before I understand low-level complexity to that degree. So let's talk instead about something that I do understand. But first, let's go get a cup of coffee, because we deserve one. So let's go get one. Okay, so noobs out there, this is your moment. This is your corner. This is the noob corner. So there are files and file choosers and all that sort of thing. I want to talk about everything having to do with files and file management and moving and copying and all that good stuff. So let's turn our attention to the screen and talk about that.
So files are important to computing. It's kind of something that we deal with frequently. And in KDE, certainly the file manager of choice is, or the default file manager anyway, is called Dolphin. And Dolphin is kind of a somewhat minimal file manager. It's kind of nice because in KDE you have a lot of flexibility. You can change things around a lot, and that's kind of liberating. I happen to like that so much that it's kind of the, for me, it's the killer feature of KDE. But one of the things that you can do in, I think, pretty much any desktop environment is to decide what your default application is going to be. So if you go to your system settings, wherever that may be on your desktop, on KDE, it's just in the K menu and it's called system settings. If you go there and look for, like, you know, some string like default applications, you should be pointed generally into the direction of default application choice. And one of them is file manager. And you can see you've got a full list of file managers here. Not all of them are actually valid. Audacious is not a file manager, but Dolphin and Conqueror and Dolphin are. Thunar is. FileLite not so much, and you can always just add your own if you want to. And there are lots of them out there. I mean, really, if you look for a file manager, if you're unhappy with all of the ones that you have to choose from, quite a few good ones that I've tried. There's RocksFiler, that's a pretty nice lightweight one. I guess that's all that I have really available here. There are lots more, though. That's interesting that that's the only extra one that we've got on Slack builds. But anyway, RocksFiler is good. XFE is good. And what is it? PCMan FM is good. So there are quite a few out there that you can try out. But anyway, Dolphin is the kind of the one that comes by default. You can modify it. You can make it your own. There's a lot of different settings. Configure Dolphin, view modes, navigation modes, different services like little plugins. There's a Git plugin which highlights things that that are being managed by Git. Just all kinds of nice little things. So, yeah, lots of flexibility there. It's quite nice. And that's great. That's Dolphin for you. But the cool thing about Dolphin, I guess, is that it's very contextual. So if I right-click in a window, then I get a menu and I can create a new folder, or I can even just create documents of certain types right from the window, which is kind of nice. I can even I can open up a terminal in this window. I can compress things, lots of different things that I can do, but we're not doing any of that right now. So I'm just going to create a folder and I'm going to call it foo. And so if I drag some files and pull it over and I don't release yet over towards foo, I can hover over Foo and it brings me right into that folder. That's an option that I have turned on in Dolphin. And if I drop them there, then I get a contextual menu about whether I want what exactly I meant to do. And this is quite handy, and this is a KDE feature, but I'm sure other desktops have it as well. But there are quick ways to do all of these things. So you can move them, you can copy them, or you can create a shortcut or link to them. And or you can just cancel. And as you can see, there's keyboard shortcuts that will let you access that without having to bother with this menu. So if I say to move everything to this folder, then it pulls them out of the previous folder and puts them into the new one. That's a move, and you probably noticed that it was the shift key that would let me do that. So if I do that again back to the original folder, holding down the shift key, then it just does that automatically. Voila. So that's kind of a handy trick. Now, the nice thing about Dolphin, aside from those shortcuts, is that you can, if you're doing something that you want to do as sort of a hybrid, you can open a terminal directly to the location where you were looking. You know, so here I am in albums, here's albums, and if I do an LS in albums, I see Red Martian and Amoeba Knievel, two really good independent artists, and so they're there. And so if I make a directory and I call it foobar, then that appears right up here as foobar. And so, I mean, ultimately I think for a lot of Linux users, the real way to move around files and to manage files is actually in the terminal, because it's just so darned fast. It can be a little bit dangerous. I mean, if you're doing crazy things, then you could feasibly screw stuff up. So if you're trying complex new commands that you don't know exactly how to do things, then yeah, that could be a problem. So if I, for instance, said for q in any aug file in this directory, copy q over to foobar and rename it as amoeba1.aug, then you might think that you just renamed all those files, but all you actually did was you took each of those files and wrote it as Amoeba 1, so the only one that you actually got in the end was the last song. Now, that having been a copy, that's not really that big of a deal, but if I had done that as a move operation and only realized my mistake afterwards, that would have been bad. So you do want to kind of test things out before you do that. But that's kind of the nice thing about terminal stuff, is that you can do for loops and things like that very quickly, or you can do things like move all the aug files here into the foobar folder, and just like that, it's done, it's moved that fast. So that is really, really nice. I mean, it's got a sort of immediacy that you just don't get anywhere else. I mean, it's just so fast. So those are two, I would say, valid options between, when it comes to managing files on Linux. You've got Dolphin and similar file management applications, and you've got Terminal. Files, of course, you can move them to the trash, and trash is here. That's where trash lives. It's pretty standard stuff. And you can also do things like compress files into tar archives or zip archives or any number of kind of archive, really. You've got a pretty good choice depending on what you've got installed on your system. So you can do that straight from your file manager, which I think these days isn't that big of a deal, but for quite some time that was very unique, I think, to Linux, to at least to have that kind of functionality out of the box. That sort of thing makes, a copy of the folder, so you can ditch your old copy or ditch this one after you email it or whatever you want to do. I guess I would, in real life, probably keep my original that I know works, just on the off chance that this corrupted something, but I have the physical disk of this, so I don't really care. And then you can extract as well. And extracting is quite handy for, I think, for one huge reason, which is you can extract here, you know, in the current location, and you can auto-detect a subfolder. So if someone forgot, you know, some people just select all the files and compress all the files together into one archive, which is okay. I'm going to take this and drop it back out into albums, which is okay, but then if I uncompress it or if I extract it just as is, just extract archive here, I get all the files. It's we call it a tar bomb, and it's quite annoying, really. In Dolphin, you can see as I'm selecting things, I hover over them, a little plus sign appears, so I can just hit the plus, and that's how I can add to my selection. And then I'll right-click and move all those to the trash. But now if I do an extract and auto-detect a directory, then it puts it into a directory, which is not completely appropriately named. I mean, it just calls it by the first file that it sees in the archive, or the first... the name of the base name of the tar archive, which in this case was the first song, because that was all it had to go off of. But at least it avoids the sort of dreaded tar bomb. That's kind of nice. But if you single click on a tar.gz, the default behavior is to open it up in a file archive view, such that you don't extract everything, but you do see everything, and you can actually even just extract selectively. So if you just wanted one song out of the archive, then you can just grab it, drag it into the folder, and now you've just pulled that out of the archive, which is kind of a nice feature. It becomes mildly problematic if this is a huge archive, like, you know, 20 gigs archive, which begs the question of why you're keeping archives that are 20 gigs around, but I mean, it's possible you might, and then clicking on it, it kind of takes forever for it to sort of parse everything and list it out for you, so sometimes that can be a little bit annoying, but more often than not, it's a little bit useful. It's kind of nice. So that's archiving and extracting archives. There are all kinds of, and that's just kind of the way they do it. You can move things and copy things just all in line. It's kind of like a very verbose terminal command or a very mouse. You can just kind of drag and keep dragging and finding things and putting things in places, so it's kind of interesting. Renaming in the terminal is not actually a rename command. Usually it's move, MV, and then the name of the current name of the folder, and then whatever you want to rename it to. So let's say that I knew wanted it to be named. This is only a test, and that's done. There's not really like an undo per se, you know, I mean, Dolphin can kind of undo some things, but in the terminal there's not really an undo function, so keep that in mind as you manage things on the terminal. Like I said, the terminal's really, really efficient, but it's also a little bit exact. It does exactly what you're asking it to do. So Dolphin, of course, has that undo buffer, which it can help you avoid dumb mistakes, whereas the terminal doesn't really help you avoid dumb mistakes. It just does what you ask it to. So last but certainly not least is finding a file. That's a really important one. So first of all, in KDE, certainly you want to have the desktop search enabled if you want to be able to find things from within KDE. This function was sort of in transition for a while, made a lot of people angry, but the later versions of KDE, the newer versions, have switched the underlying engine to their file indexer, and it, I have to say, it works a lot better than what it used to do, so that's kind of nice, but it does need to be on in order for it to work. So let's say that I have this find file thing up here, although I never actually use it, but I do have it there, and otherwise you can just hit Control F in Dolphin, and it will give you a little search box, and you can search file name or the contents of the file from wherever you are. depending on what folder you are in, it will reflect that. Or you can search from everywhere. So we'll just do from here, and we'll just search the file name, and I happen to know that I have a file called Compose. Apparently I have a couple of files called Compose, and those are my Compose files, four of them. If I right-click on one of them, then I can either open that path in a new window or in a new tab, or I can, of course, just open the file directly however I want to open it. So I'll just do it in a new window, I guess. And here we are. It's in my reference directory, and it's somewhere in here. And in fact, that's a good point. So in Dolphin, I also, at the bottom of the Dolphin window, I have a filter bar, which again you can get from Configure Dolphin. And that's kind of handy, because if you know that you're in the right folder as something, and you just really want to quick search for that thing, then you can just type in, you know, whatever string, or maybe you know that it's a text file, whatever. So that's kind of cool. Between those two, I think finding a file pretty much it's pretty nice, I would say, in Dolphin. And in later editions of KDE, you even have sort of doing things by file types. So, for instance, recently accessed, today, yesterday, this month, last month, or search for all documents, all images, all audio files, all videos. So you can do that too, which gives you a lot of flexibility in terms of how you want to, you know, if you know that you were just editing a file yesterday and just can't for the life of you find it, you can just click yesterday and it will open up everything from yesterday. And this is actually not incorrect. Yesterday I did not have this computer on, so it's actually not lying to you. It's weird, but yeah, true. Okay, so I would be remiss if I did not cover really, really quickly the find command. It's really handy. I'm sure I've probably covered it before, but I'm going to do it again really quick-like. So if I just said find tilde dash I name, so case insensitive name, and then quote, and I'll do a asterisk compose asterisk quote, because I don't exactly know what the name of the file is. I just know that it's got the word compose in it. So I'm surrounding it by wildcards, and I'm enclosing that with double quotes so that the shell doesn't intercept anything. So file tilde dash I name quote star compose star quote return. And that will show me that, yes, I have in a Emacs backup folder a compose tilde file, and in some Amarok stuff I've got some composer data, and eventually it will show up that I've also got the compose stuff in wherever that was in Dolphin. And that's a pretty complete search. I mean, it'll search through a lot because I've got a huge home directory right now. It's got lots of multimedia stuff in it, and games and all kinds of. But generally speaking, I mean, especially if you know roughly where you want to search, then you can just do a find. And there's lots of different things that you can do to filter it. You dash type F for files, or D for directories. So that's find. It's a very handy command. There's a lot more you can do with it, but I don't want to make this about find. I just wanted to make it about finding files. So those are the two ways to do that.
So that's everything you could possibly want to know about files, I imagine. That covers it. So now you know. Now you know everything about file management on Linux. Now let's talk about font management. I touched on this at one point many episodes ago. I was talking about how, well, it was the time I was talking about in the Noob Corner, actually, on how to install fonts. And I mentioned offhand that, hey, you should keep track of all your fonts. That's not what I want to talk about here. I want to talk more about how fonts are handled across all. Again, it's not a Linux thing. It's a worldwide multi-platform issue that ought to be addressed. And so I'm addressing it here. Whether anyone hears this or not, it's another question, but I do want to talk about it. So right now, how many fonts do you have on your system? I can tell you that I have, I think, 2,455 fonts on my system. How many of those are actually loaded into, like, the font system that, you know, that comes up in my menu? Nowhere near that. It's more like 100. But of those fonts, assuming you know the number, and I don't, but I'm saying, I'm guessing around 100 for myself. So of those, could you tell me how many were serif and how many were sans serif? How many were, say, calligraphic font? How many of them are like the handwriting fonts? How many of them are monospaced? Could you tell me? Well, okay, what if you cheated and went onto your computer right now and looked in your font menu? Could you tell me then? The answer is actually probably not. And that's a problem, I think. The fact that fonts, especially in the design space, and again, this is not a Linux issue, this is a cross-platform, everyone's problem issue. But in the design world, amazingly, there's really no effective... Now, there are some third-party applications that attempt to make this better, but it's not where it needs to be. And I don't mean like it's not, it hasn't progressed enough. I mean, it's not physically located, physically in computer space. It's not located where it needs to be. It's a third party thing. It doesn't actually affect the applications that you're running. It's another application that you have to run. So there's no really great way of figuring out on your system, like just what's a serif, what's a sans serif, where are my calligraphy fonts? Where's my monospace? Where's my graffiti style fonts? Where's my foreign style fonts? There's no way. When you open up a font menu, all you see is a list of every font on your system. Doesn't matter where they come from or what they're like. It's a list. It's a big, ugly, complicated list. Font naming is also a real problem, and this isn't, I'm not switching gears as much as it sounds like. So font file names are totally random. Download a font, it might come to you as grand space a space moi dot ttf. That's one name. And then you download something else and it might be grand underscore a underscore moi dot ttf. And then you might download a different one. I'm using the same name just to illustrate the difference. And then you download a different one, and it's all caps, grandamo underscore dot ttf. And that's the kind of, that's a sample of the variety of font naming schemes that you will find if you go out and find some fonts. Now, it's interesting because we had the same problem with music and even movies and TV shows up until really, I think, XBMC / Plex. And even probably some other applications like maybe, you know, I mean, a lot of the CD rippers and stuff like that, like ABCDE and K3B, all those kinds of applications. So, I mean, originally, like music and movies and stuff, I mean, you just called them whatever you called them, but it started getting, it sort of somehow kind of filtered its way into a convention of being like the artist underscore, the album underscore, the track number underscore, the track title dot suffix. And that just kind of arose out of really all these probably open source applications just insisting on that's how we're going to name these tracks. Now, closed source applications, being traditionally a lot stupider than open source applications, they tried to do other things like, well, instead of putting it all in the name, we'll make this whole directory structure. And so we'll have the artist name, and in the artist's name there'll be the album that belongs to, and then we'll have a list of all the songs inside of there, and that's how we'll do it. Which obviously, I mean, the file itself then loses description, it loses a lot of information if you remove it from that file structure, which I think is a problem. I mean, it's there's definitely a place for that kind of contextual information, but I mean, why not put it all in the name if it can be easily summarized in that name? I mean, some things, yeah, you can't put all in a file name. There's some stuff that has such variety that you couldn't possibly do that. But for something that is as standard as artist, album, track number track title, it all fits. You put it in its file name. It becomes perfectly self-descriptive automatically. And luckily, that caught on, and things like XBMC and Plex and open source media players, like whatever it might be, whether it's Juck or MRock or VLC or Audacious or XMMS, you name it, Clementine, Rhythmbox, Banshee, Quad Lidette, I don't know, I forget that one. But yeah, lots of different ones. They just kept using this file name schema, and it could just parse it perfectly because it's standardized by force of habit. Works out really nicely. So you know what? Why don't we do the same thing with fonts, I'm wondering. And I'm surprised that no one in the design community has not actually thought of this yet. But I mean, you could do something like sans underscore liberation underscore regular dot ttf. I mean, that would perfectly describe that font. It would be the type of font that it is. It's a sans font, the family that it belongs to, liberation, and the variation or the version of that font. It's the regular version as opposed to the bold or the italics, and then dot ttf or dot otf or whatever kind of font it is. And that would work. I mean, you could do that with sans, you could do it with serif, you could do it with, like I say, monospace. You could do it with a lot of different things. Gothic, you know, I mean, all that stuff you could put into a file name. And there's not that much variation in font stuff, you know? It really is. There are certain very definable things that you can use to describe a font by. You know, it's a handwritten, it's monospace, it's serif, it's sans serif. It's pretty good. I mean, you do get like those edge cases of, oh, this is a graffiti style font. But I mean, and you know, you could argue, well, okay, we'll just create a new tag because that's a very common thing. Or you'd say, well, graffiti, handwritten, same thing, we'll lump it in. That's all debatable, and that's something for the font geeks to work out among themselves. Once they adopt my method, which I don't really anticipate being anytime soon, but this is just an idea. But the really, really cool thing about this, and this is like the thing that I think is brilliant, would be like when you go to a font menu. What if when you clicked on a font menu, instead of seeing just a monolithic list of all of your fonts, you know, and what drives me crazy about these font menus half the time is that it is just, it's a big list, and it lists every variety of liberation, and every variety of deja vu, and every variety of bitstream, and every variety of whatever. And you've got this like this list, and there's regular, regular bold, regular italics, italics bold, oblique, inverted, outlined, you know, and it's just like, okay, yes, I get it. I have 20 versions of liberation on my, and you know, I've got 10 versions of liberation, and then 10 more of it with serif, you know, and it's just, it's like so many versions of fonts, and they're just, it's just on and on. And that's not how you choose fonts, I don't think, typically. You want to go to the menu, and then you should see the varieties first. You should see, okay, here are all my sans, or yeah, here's all my sans fonts. And there could be a submenu for all of the sans. And then you would only see, like, you know, 10 liberations, because those are just the sans. Or you could do another drop-down menu, I guess, if you could just say liberation, and then you could say, well, here's all the different varieties of liberation you have. You've got regular, you've got italics, and you've got bold, and you've got outlined, or whatever. I'm just making stuff up now. And then you've got, back under the main menu, you've got sans, and then you've got serif, and then you've got mono, and then you've got handwritten, and you've got gothic, or whatever. I guess gothic. Would gothic be? I don't know. Point being, you've got these major categories, and in that major category, then you would have all of your different font families, and within those families, you've got the type of variation upon that font family. I think that would be a brilliant method for choosing fonts. It would be descriptive. It would be easy to find, and I mean, even just getting just the serif versus the sans serif would be an improvement, but I think we could take it a couple of levels further and have, you know, at least like mono and something else. And yeah, that would be fantastic, because there are so many things about fonts that are not subjective. You know, you can absolutely describe fonts with fairly, you know, technical but common terminology that does accurately describe that font. It's not very often you have a debate with someone over whether this font is or is not a script, or if it's a type. You know, if it's handwritten or if it looks like a typed letter. I mean, that's usually pretty clear. There are always those exceptions, like the ones that are like dirty typewriters, you know, and it's like, well, I mean, it is typed because it's styled to look like a typewriter, but it's so stylistic that we could argue that it's something else. But, you know, again, those are just like those are edge cases that I could sacrifice. I mean, I'll stand it if you miscategorize my ugly typewriter font as a stylistic font, so it doesn't deserve to be in my normal serif category. That's fine. We can hash that out later. I just think that it would be brilliant to come up with like a standard naming scheme that could then be parsed for better menu management of fonts. So that's my idea. Take it and implement it if you want. Tell developers about this idea. Promote it among the design communities. I think it's a brilliant idea. I would love to see this. And it would unfortunately have to be something that became a convention, you know, within the applications. Because it's really not about like that third party application that will help me organize my fonts. That's not what I want to see. I don't want it to be in a third application, in a third party application. I want it to be in every single font menu on every single platform. I want to open up fonts and have it logically organized such that I can find what I need quickly without sorting through this monolithic list that just tells me names that are semi-parsed and somewhat nonsensical. It just doesn't work for me. So, I don't know. Let me know what you think of that idea, because I think it's a great one. I think that's about all the time we have for this episode. So thank you for watching or listening, and I will talk to you in 2 weeks.
That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.